With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. New varieties of cantaloupes can now be found at your local grocery markets, and that means tossing out your old tips and tricks of picking out the ripest melons. So California cantaloupes say there's no need to thump or smell a cantaloupe anymore. It's actually better if they don't have a fragrant smell. And instead of looking for a stemless fruit, you'll want one with the stem intact a little bit, and even better if it has some netting on it. So here are three tips to remember. If you're looking for a melon, cream and green color is all right. Don't overthink the stem. If it's there, great. If it has netting, even better. Lastly, the blossom's end should have a bit of cracking and a slight softness. So giving that melon a light squeeze doesn't mean imperfection. It actually means sweet ripeness. So if you'd like to find out more information on exactly how to pick that ripe melon and for recipes, you can visit CaliforniaCantaloupes.com. And now let's get into today's show headlines. Ag stakeholders working on a proposed feed additives bill. Senate Bill 485 recently made its way out of the Senate Appropriations Committee. This bill would require California Air Resources Control Board and the California Department of Food and Agriculture to create a feed additive program to reduce emissions come August 1st of 2026. In addition, it would require CARB and CDFA to provide the legislature with a report 2 years after a safe and effective feed additive is commercially available, about further funding and scientific research that is necessary to improve the incentive program, and convene work groups to provide a comprehensive assessment to the legislator of the potential impacts of feed additives. California Farm Bureau says, quote, while the current goal of the program would greatly benefit dairy cattle and help reach Senate Bill 1383's 40% emission reduction goals, that same cannot be said for beef and feeder operations. Farm Bureau is actively working with bill sponsor Josh Becker in regards to amendments to this bill. They also want more agricultural stakeholders to be a part of the work group to ensure a comprehensive assessment of feed additive impacts. And now here's Brian Derman with more agriculture news.
The Marin County Ag Team Professional Development Program brought city officials together to get a better understanding of agricultural needs at a local level. Graduate student assistant Ellen Camps described how educating the Ag Team, which consisted of 21 members across 8 different departments, resulted in a greater appreciation of farming concerns.
So we had building and safety, planning and land use, environmental health, public works, parks, assessor recorder, code compliance, housing and grants. And for that year, we had 11 webinars on production methods, stewardship practices, access to land, agritourism, along with various other topics. We also hosted 3 field trips with our generous hosts on the farm. We looked at production systems, dairy, livestock, specialty crops, processing, cheese making, mead production, livestock slaughter, compost, and following those learning encounters, our ag team brought forth 28 recommendations with support and facilitation from Extension Marin. And those are 28 department-specific recommendations for changes to county policy and procedures that would help agricultural producers remain viable.
Heavy fly infestations on dairy operations can take a substantial toll on cow comfort, health, and productivity. Technical Services Entomologist with Central Life Sciences, Kylie Sherrill, explained some of the impacts that can be expected if fly populations are not adequately managed.
High populations of flies are not only a nuisance to the animals, but to our workers as well. And it really doesn't take that many flies to quickly impact the bottom line, not only in lost productivity, but control costs as well. Stable fly populations can easily lower milk production 15 to 30%, and it's estimated to cost the industry $250 million or more per year in both lost productivity and control cost. And honestly, control costs are better spent being proactive and preventing the population than being reactive and having the control cost on top of the lost productivity.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
What GMO crops are grown and sold in the U.S.? Well, there's corn, like me, soybeans, canola, sugar beets, and cotton. Typically, we're ingredients in certain foods. GMO alfalfa, corn, soybeans, canola, and cotton are used as animal food. And while you won't find many GMOs in the produce section, there are versions of GMO apple, summer squash, potato, and papaya in a few markets. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, former chief trade negotiator for Mexico, Kenneth Smith Ramos, says the U.S. must remember to remain within the confines of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement as it looks at ways to protect domestic producers.
What we see in Mexico is that because of the success that tomatoes, avocados, berries, and many other products have had in the U.S., there's of course the push in the United States to try to shut down that access. But if it's done in a way that's violating USMCA rules or WTO rules, then eventually this is going to lead to major litigation.
Smith Ramos was Mexico's lead negotiator for the USMCA, as well as the NAFTA agreement it replaced. He says the protections within the USMCA are important.
Because one of the big advantages of the USMCA is that, you know, you in the United States have large areas of land with good irrigation that allow you to produce grains, oil seeds, meat products, and those go into Mexico at a competitive price. Vice versa, Mexico is able to grow vegetables and fruits all year long, and it satisfies the needs, especially of the northern states, throughout the entire year. So there are great benefits to consumers of having free trade. And of course, there are rules established in the trade agreements that say, in case there are unfair trading practices, you can, you know, call for investigations and the imposition of duties. But these have to be done within the rules. You can't just change the rules in order to use them as protectionist measures.
In an earlier interview, Florida Congresswoman Kat Kamick expressed concern over a lack of protection for U.S. produce growers. She used the example of tomatoes, which have had a suspension agreement limiting some tomatoes from Mexico since about 4 years after NAFTA was put into effect due to the rapid decline of U.S. tomato production caused by the influx of tomatoes from Mexico.
Started under NAFTA, where there wasn't those acknowledgments that our domestic producers, particularly with tomatoes, would be hit hardest under NAFTA. As a result of years of hard work, there was a tomato suspension agreement put in place, which was designed to protect our domestic tomato farmers. What we have seen, though, is a lack of enforcement, and that has caused us to go from hundreds of tomato operations, commercial operations in the state of Florida, to now just a couple dozen. And we are now at that tipping point where we see USMCA, which rectified a lot of issues, certainly, but left Florida in the cold once again when it came to protecting our domestic producers. When you have 300 specialty crops that harvest about the same time as Mexico and Central America, that right there is setting the stage for a problem.
The tomato suspension agreement was created in 1996 to keep Mexican tomatoes from flooding the U.S. market. Kamick says it is a vivid example of how the nation's seasonal and perishable crop producers need more protection in trade agreements.
When you compare the two producers, say Florida producers to Mexican producers, this isn't apples to apples, this is apples to oranges. What we pay in an hour in terms of labor, they pay in a day in Mexico. What we abide by in terms of regulatory structure is 50, 60, 70 years ahead. They're using chemicals that were outlawed 50 plus years ago. What we do in terms of environmental stewardship is far advanced beyond what we see in other parts of the world. And so there really is no level playing field. Then you couple the fact that is harvested at the same time and then dumped on our market, it bottoms out the price for our producers.
That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, those in the cattle industry are very familiar with the fact numbers of the nation's beef cattle herd have been decreasing over the past few months. But as Gary Crawford reports, many are wondering when the herd reduction starts to reverse itself.
It looks like the downsizing of the nation's beef herd is continuing unabated, not slowing down, and certainly not reversing.
We believe that this is corroborated by the published estimates.
USDA livestock analyst Justin Cho, the latest estimates coming in last Friday's USDA Cattle on Feed report showing placements of cattle into feedlots during April down 4% from April of last year, marketings of fed cattle down about 6%. And so
the number of cattle on feed on May 1st was estimated at 11.6 million head, which is about 3% below the previous year.
So Justin says the beef industry ship is still sailing on a herd reduction course.
Even though prices are high and with projected lower feed prices, which increased the economic incentive for producers to turn the ship around, the biological lag in cattle will probably delay any note of turnaround until next year.
But more likely 2025.
This isn't a huge surprise. This is what we've been anticipating now for many months.
That voice belongs to Mark Jekinowski. He's chairman of USDA's Outlook Board and looking out to 2024.
Beef production, we have forecast to decline just about 2.2 billion pounds.
Or a little less than 1% decline at 24.75 billion pounds. Now, a minute ago, we heard Justin Cho mention a couple of possible factors that might be incentives for producers to start rebuilding herds. One is the possibility of significantly lower feed costs. USDA is forecasting right now corn prices to drop by as much as 27%, soybeans by about 15% in 2024. Cho also mentioned higher cattle prices as a possible incentive for a herd rebuild. Mark Jekinowski is forecasting steer prices next year to average 172.25 hundredweight.
Just over $5 per hundredweight from the current calendar year.
Or about a 3.5% increase brought about, of course, by short supplies of cattle.
And continued relatively strong demand.
But, of course, all of these forecasts for next year, still very highly tentative. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Thanks, Gary. And in this month's American Sheep Industry Association Research Update podcast, Rosie Bush, DVM of the University of California Davis School of Veterinary Medicine, addresses sheep disease prevention and treatment strategies. It's the first of a two-part podcast tackling vaccines this month. To hear this podcast, go to the American Sheep Industry Association website, sheepusa.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Many crops depend on healthy pollinators. From beetles to flies, hummingbirds, bats, and bees, pollinators are essential in helping turn pollen into food. June 19th through 25th is National Pollinator Week, reminding us of the key role pollinators play in preserving natural habitats and producing successful crops. This message is brought to you by Syngenta, committed to protecting the safety and health of pollinators that feed and fuel the world.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
Grilling season is officially underway, but what if you don't have a grill? That's coming up on This Land of Ours. Cooking burgers on the grill is the most traditional method of cooking those burgers this summer, but what if you don't have a grill? No problem, says the top chef at the Beef It's What's for Dinner brand. If you need to cook a burger indoors, a cast iron skillet is the perfect method. Using a skillet allows the burgers to cook in their own juices for a burger with a rich flavor profile. Then there's smokers and pellet grills, which have increased in popularity over the past several years. Cooking on a smoker will give similar results to grilling, but leaves room for flavor customization, depending on what wood you choose. And you may have seen waffle burgers trending on social media lately. While they may not become your primary burger cooking method, it does work and might be a fun way to get those social media-loving kids away from the screen and into the kitchen. Get more tips and a link to recipes on our website, agnetwest.com. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen. With an expense method depreciation election, you can deduct all or part of the income tax basis of your farm machinery and equipment and other types of qualified property in the year the items are placed in service. But there's a potential trap that can apply to farm landlords that is often overlooked. Expense method depreciation can be claimed on machinery and equipment, as well as purchased breeding stock, pickup trucks, and business automobiles. It can also be claimed on tile lines, fences, feeding floors, grain bins, and silos. However, for a non-corporate landlord that leases tangible personal property to a tenant, including the landlord's own entity, and wants to claim expense method depreciation on the leased property, the landlord must make sure the lease is properly structured. The lease term must be less than half of the class life of the property involved. That means the lease must be in writing. The term of an oral farm lease is perpetual, automatically renewing from year to year if notice to terminate is not given. That rule burned an Iowa farmer to the tune of about $100,000. He orally leased his farm equipment to his corporation and tried to claim expense method depreciation. Also, during the first 12 months of the lease, business expenses related to the leased property must exceed 15% of the rental income the property produces. This rule can influence the amount of rent charged under the lease. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen.
It is among USDA's better-known conservation offerings, one focused on both regional conservation efforts and collaboration within those efforts.
The Regional Conservation Partnership Program is really an innovative program that allows partners and individual entities to partner with NRCS in bringing together additional resources, leveraging public and private partnership opportunities to provide additional funding to individual landowner projects.
Karen Woodrich is with the Natural Resources Conservation Service, which oversees RCPP. She emphasizes the locality of program projects.
Different priority projects across the landscape that are really driven by the locally led process. So locally, through our local state technical committees and stakeholder input, we're able to identify priorities across those landscapes to be able to enter into some innovative agreements and offer some additional flexibilities through the RCPP program that you wouldn't maybe necessarily get through our regular covered farm bill programs.
Recently, the announcement was made for application proposals for project funding under the Regional Conservation Partnership Program.
We are announcing $500 million in the 2023 request for proposals. And of that, it is split between some Inflation Reduction Act dollars, which prioritize climate mitigation activities. And then there are 2018 Farm Bill funds as a part of that $500 million as well.
In addition, up to $50 billion is being set aside
specifically for alternative funding arrangements specifically targeted towards Indian tribes.
Alternative funding arrangements are one of two options within RCPP, the second being what is known as the Classic Program. Applications for both categories of projects are being accepted through August 18th. Via NRCS's Regional Conservation Partnership Program online portal. That information is available through local USDA service centers or at www.nrcs.usda.gov. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
May 2023 is ending as the second driest on record in many parts of the Midwest, data going back 153 years. I'm Mark Oppold with your bottom line report this last day of May, brought to you by Superior Livestock. Indeed, if current 6 to 10 and 8 to 14 day weather forecasts hold true, many areas of eastern Iowa, northern Illinois, northern Indiana will receive less than a half an inch of rain over a 4-week period. Other areas, Nebraska, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Ohio, have not fared a lot better. Agronomists say putting the corn crop under this kind of stress just before pollination will affect top yields. Now they add, this scenario not as bad for soybeans, as we know late July, early August is their critical time period. And we wonder if heavy rain coming to the wheat belt is coming in time to save that crop. This is the Bottom Line Report. Superior Livestock officials say weaned calves continue in short supply. Feeder cattle under 850 pounds setting new high prices for late spring sales, $7 to $15 higher from the previous week. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day.
More reactions to the Supreme Court's WOTUS decision. U.S. agriculture groups continue reacting positively to the Supreme Court's unanimous ruling in the Sackett versus EPA case that rejected the WOTUS definition. National Cattlemen's Beef Association President Todd Wilkinson says cattle producers can breathe a sigh of relief. The decision refocuses the Clean Water Act on protecting our water through regulatory clarity. The Fertilizer Institute also welcomed the decision. TFI President and CEO Corey Rosenbusch said the decision to strike down the significant nexus test is a win for agriculture. This is a great first step to needed clarity for the fertilizer industry's long-term planning and capital investments that will allow us to keep providing critical crop nutrients. The National Pork Producers Council called the decision a tremendous victory for pork producers. NPPC Vice President Dwayne Statler said, "This ruling is a clear punctuation point after decades of attempts to expand the federal government's control of private land." I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
Good day, everybody. Albert J. Hernandez, the on-time chef for Agnet West. Welcome to the California Kitchen, where you can learn how to cook from an award-winning chef in under 3 minutes or less. I'm your host with the most. Let's get untamed. I've been getting a lot of requests on Instagram, Facebook, and emails on how to make really great chicken. So here is that recipe for all of you incredible fans and followers of what we're doing here on the California Kitchen. So starting off first, we're going to be doing some free-range chicken breasts. And by free-range, I also mean air-chilled. We don't want any chicken that's been compromised or been frozen. It is important to have air chilled because it's going to have a better texture. And if you don't believe me, trust me, the details are in great, great ingredients. Now, what I'm going to be doing is I'm going to be seasoning this with salt and pepper. And I always put my salt and pepper on the skin side first. And I want to be able to see that salt and pepper. When I always say to taste, capital T, that means it's always a preference. However, I want it to be a certain way. So I want to make sure the salt and pepper is on that chicken breast and I want to be able to see it because that tells me that I know it's on there. I'm going to flip it over and I'm going to do the exact same thing. Now I have four people in my family, so I'm going to do this times four. I'm also going to add to this our Cajun spice as well as our dehydrated garlic. And last but definitely not least, I am also going to add to this some chives. This is so important because we're gonna have some really great flavors. Now I'm gonna put my skillet on a medium high heat. Once that skillet goes on that medium high heat, what I'm going to do next is I am going to put it into the pan and I'm going to let it sit skin side down for 2 minutes. All I'm adding to that pan too is just 1.5 tablespoons of vegetable oil. I'm going to flip it over. Once I flip it over, I'm going to add now to this 1/4 tablespoon of butter, and I'm going to start the basting process. I'm going to bring that butter to a nice heat and we're going to baste the chicken with that. My oven should have already been preheated to 325 degrees and I'll have a pan ready that once all the chickens have been basted, they're going to go into this pan and they're going to go into the oven at 325 degrees for approximately 8 minutes. This is going to make sure that our chicken hits an internal temperature of 165 degrees. And by the time it comes off of that skillet after being basted, it should be about 155, 160. So it's only carrying over 5 degrees, which is going to make sure your chicken is juicy and absolutely delicious. Now, it is important once the chicken comes out to let it rest for about 5 minutes before slicing it and cutting into it, so we can make sure that all the juices go back to the center and it doesn't make a mess on your plate. For this and many tips, tricks, and all things Untamed, go to www.ajhtheuntamedchef.com. And as always, this is Albert J., the Untamed Chef for Agnet West.
Producers whose crops and livestock were impacted by weather disasters are familiar with USDA's emergency relief program.
The department was given $10 billion to help assist producers who had weather-related emergencies or disasters in the 2020 and 2021 calendar years.
And emergency livestock relief program.
Part of that $10 billion was a $750 million carve-out for livestock producers.
Farm Service Agency Administrator Zach Ducheneau will soon see applications for both programs in the near future. Funding has been announced for both ERP and ELRP for producers suffering eligible losses of commodities in calendar year 2022. $3.7 billion total, with about $500 million earmarked for livestock producers who suffered drought and wildfire losses in that same time period. The administrator also notes changes in the latest editions of ERP and ELRP compared to previous offerings.
We heard loud and clear from the countryside that we shouldn't have to ask for more information when we've got it all on file in the department. So as we built these two programs out, we took a look at the information that we had, not just at the FSA, but also with our sister agency, the Risk Management Agency.
So in the case of the Emergency Livestock Relief Program,
we used existing livestock forage disaster program data to deliver payments to producers without them taking any action at all.
In fact, LFP program data will assist in increases in 2022 supplemental feed cost under the Emergency Livestock Relief Program. Meanwhile, producers eligible for the Emergency Relief Program will receive pre-filled applications directly sometime early this summer, with an ERP track for producers with either federal crop insurance or non-insured disaster assistance. Administrator Ducheneau says while most producers should have required forms for either ERP or ELRP already on file at local FSA offices, he encourages them to go ahead and get confirmation of data and documents filed. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
And now, another episode of One Soil to Live.
All right, let's take a look, Claude. I see you've been keeping it covered.
Yes, I have.
And it appears you haven't disturbed it.
Well, I've tried really hard not to.
You're using living roots throughout the year with diverse species in rotations, right?
Just exactly as you prescribed, Doctor.
Well, I'll have to say I'm impressed with your organic matter, aggregation, and microbial activity. Claude, I'm happy to report that your soil is fit as a fiddle.
Oh, thank you. I guess it's true that soil health management systems are just what the doctor ordered.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
Improving soil health can make your farm more productive, profitable, and resilient. Visit your local USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service office today and learn more about the basics and benefits of soil health. This message brought to you by USDA and this radio station.
Welcome back to the show. We have the latest episode of The Voices of the Valley today, where show hosts Dennis Donahue and Candace Wilson speak with Josh Ruiz from Church Brothers Farms about his attitude toward trying new technologies and approaches.
Welcome to Voices of the Valley, a series interviewing growers, entrepreneurs, educators, and technologists who are inventing new solutions for today's and tomorrow's challenges on the farm. Brought to you by Reedley College, educating the next generation of agriculturalists in advanced technology, efficient production practices, and food safety. Now here's your hosts of Voices of the Valley, Dennis Donahue and Candace Wilson.
This is Dennis Donahue, and welcome back to Voices of the Valley. We have another terrific guest, Josh Ruiz, who is the Senior Director of Ag Technology and Innovation. Josh, welcome. And I think you recognize my faithful partner, Candace Wilson. Candace, hello.
Hi. And how are you today, Josh?
I'm well. Thank you for having me.
Yo, you're welcome. Well, this will be fun because all of us know each other pretty well and we've worked together. And we're looking forward to this conversation. You know, Josh, it so happened we had an interesting conversation last night, which we'll talk about. But we're going to out you as a regular listener of the podcast, which has no bearing on our reason for asking you to join us for this episode. Completely independent. But as a regular listener, you know, the first thing we like to do is ask our guests to tell us about themselves, their career journey to what they're doing today, and then what they're doing today. So tell us a little bit about your background and how you ended up the Senior Director of Ag Technology and Innovation.
Sure. Yeah. No, I'll be honest, I'm a proud listener. I travel up and down the road a lot, around the country a lot at this point. And I truly enjoy listening to the guests that you guys have on and the conversations you guys have. You guys are talking about a lot of good things. And I think it's important these conversations are being had. So definitely a proud listener. I was born and raised in Salinas, and my family had nothing to do with agriculture. I tell people all the time, farming started and stopped at the grocery store for my family. And one day just before high school, I decided, you know, I better go educate myself on what's going on around me. And I drove out to the nearest farm, knowing no different, and asked the farmer if I could just ride around with him. I didn't want any money. I just wanted to ride around and educate myself on what was happening. And after a week of riding around with him, fell in love with farming and thought, you know, this is a good, honest way to make a living. So this is what I want to do. And I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world at this point. I was meant to be a farmer and be in the ag business. And I love it. Went off to school, Cal Poly, and came back and started in the fresh vegetable business here in the Salinas Valley, and have been doing it ever since.
Well, you know, one of the things I like about that story is, you know, that attitude of I want to know what's going on around me. I think you've, as I've known you over the years, you've really carried that into how you've taken a look at this whole area of technology and innovation. And I want to get into that a little bit, but talk a little bit about what you're doing at Duda and then just your experience with ag tech and innovation, because as I say, that curiosity seems to have really driven your interest in innovation and technology and really taking the time to look at everything. As I often tell people, well, if you can get to Josh Ruiz, he's seen everything. And but, you know, you got to be willing to do that. So talk about that and what you're doing.
Sure. No, I came back from school and came into the ag business. And, you know, I started learning from a lot of the old timers, we'll call them, who have become some of my greatest mentors and friends over the years. But what I quickly learned was they were just doing things that had been done year over year over year and generation after generation. And I'm a Nintendo kid. I was born and raised with a Nintendo in my hand. And, you know, I was the start of that computer generation, if you were. And people would tell me, well, this is just the way it's always been done. And that would seem like a very strange response to me. I didn't understand that. And I am a very inquisitive type person. I want to know what's behind the curtain or why does this happen or why does this go that way or whatever. And because of that, over the years, I have been willing to look at a lot of different things and ask a lot of different questions. And I have just had an interest in doing things differently. Can it be done better? Can we build a better mousetrap? Can we build a better plant or a better tractor or whatever? And I've been fortunate to ask a lot of questions and stumble my way through a lot of different technologies and innovations over the years. And that has led me to where I'm at today with Duda. And Duda has brought me here to join their team to be, you know, a leader or the person who gathers all the technologies and brings Duda into that next generation so that we can be better farmers, better stewards of our resources. And Duda is about to celebrate its 100th anniversary of being in business. And they recognize if we don't innovate and if we don't do some of these things, they won't be here for another 100 years. So the point is, let's see how we can become better and make it another 100 years after this.
I love that. I am curious, can you highlight some of, so over the course of your career, you've had your hands in all kinds of exciting innovation projects. What are some of the projects that you've been a part of that you feel most proud of?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of different things. One was a broccoli harvester that my team and I invented, basically. And we came up with it with parts and pieces from all kinds of different other industries. It was never meant to harvest broccoli, but my team and I saw a way to put the parts and pieces together and create that harvester, which I'm still very proud of to this day. And we were able to actually harvest some other crops with the two, which was interesting. So that's one I'm really proud of. And then the other, you know, thing is technology is not always, I've mentioned this to both of you guys over the years, and technology is not just about robots and machines and tractors all the time, but sometimes it's about being smarter and analyzing data and things like that. And my team and I have in the past have done a lot of deep dive into data and just take away the gut feeling that farming comes naturally in farming. You know, we tend to run with our guts a lot in farming as an industry. And my team and I have been able to find ways to analyze the data, collect data that we weren't collecting before, and truly make some decisions that are data-driven, not gut-driven, which is another thing I'm really proud of. You know, so those are a couple different things I've been involved in.
Well, you know, one of my favorite stories is I want to pick up on the broccoli. And to the degree you can talk about this, but share the story of how you took a look at the whole broccoli deal and said, you know, there may be, I'm not sure you knew it at the time, though I'm guessing you did, like, hey, we may need to make an agronomic play here. You know, this may not be a matter of technology. It may be a matter of looking at seed varieties and that whole story, because I think it's an important one. One, I think it speaks to, you know, that curiosity, inquisitiveness we talked about, and you like to try things. But I think the other thing is, and I'll ask you to comment after you tell the story, when it comes to automation and you've looked at everything that's out there, you know, are we still overly preoccupied with the technology, and do there need to be more commitments, you know, to agronomics? You know, do we need to be looking more seriously at orchard design and that type of thing? But start with the broccoli story.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was tasked with, can we build a broccoli harvester? And I'm not an engineer. I'm not really even a mechanic. I don't even change the oil on my car. That's not my forte. But I was looking at equipment, and nothing I could see out there would even remotely come close to fitting what we did on the farm. And one day it dawned on me that, well, why do we need to keep the farm the same? We don't. So I was able to go back and look at my farming practices and say, well, what can I do with equipment? What is the closest thing I can come up with equipment-wise today? And where's our technology at today? And I was able to go back and modify my farming practices to fit the technology that I had available to me or that I thought was best at the time.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. May is Water Awareness Month, and between historic drought, atmospheric rivers, and flooding, California has experienced quite a tug of water wars the last few years. However, even with the massive dumping of snow and water across the state, California Department of Food and Agriculture remains focused on continuing to provide water-saving programs and practices to help future-proof the state's water supply. Over the last 9 years, the CDFA State Water Efficiency and Enhancement Program, also known as SWEEP, has provided $123 million to help fund more than 1,100 projects covering more than 168,000 acres. Also, SWEEP recently unveiled its Block Grant Program, which will help advance California's commitment to building more resilient water supplies amid the state's extreme wet and dry weather swings. It will also test whether block grantees can accelerate the disbursements of funds and better coordinate community needs for technical assistance. CDFA Secretary Karen Ross says, quote, "Water conservation is a shared priority throughout California, but each region of California is unique in its water supply challenges and solutions. We hope the SWEEP block grant can provide an opportunity for regional strategies to be supported." $40 million is currently up for grabs, and organizations have until June 19 to apply for the Block Grant Program. For more information on this and other water-related programs, visit cdfa.ca.gov.
The California Department of Food and Agriculture is accepting applications for the department's first historically underserved and small farm advisory committees. The Small Scale Producer Advisory Committee will advise the CDFA Secretary and the California State Board of Food and Ag on matters pertaining to small and medium-scale producers related to programs, research, technology, workforce development, technical assistance, and equity issues. The Black, Indigenous, and People of Color Producer Advisory Committee will advise on matters pertaining to the implementation of the Farmer Equity Act. Committees will meet on a quarterly basis 4 times per calendar year. Appointments are for 4-year terms, with initial appointments being staggered. The application periods for both of the new committees will remain open through June 30th. More information about the committees is available on the Board and Commission's index page at cdfa.ca.gov. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
The Urban Advisory Committee is now taking nominations. Some background on the Urban Ag and Innovative Production Committee as it's currently taking nominations. The Office of Urban Agriculture and Innovative Production Director Brian Gussey explains the development and mission of a federal advisory committee providing feedback on urban agriculture and innovative production.
When the Office of Urban Agriculture and Innovative Production was first stood up under the same statutory language of the 2018 Farm Bill that created the office, Congress also instructed USDA to stand up a federal advisory committee on issues related to urban agriculture and innovative production. This federal advisory committee advises the Secretary of Agriculture on the development of policies and outreach relating to urban, indoor, and other emerging agricultural production practices. So the members of the committee provide input on policy development and help identify barriers to urban agriculture and innovative production as USDA works to promote urban farming and the economic opportunities it provides to communities across the country.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.